So let's go ahead and get started because we've got a lot to get through today. When I was pulling trend pieces for you guys, I realized that there's so many different lengths, and we've mostly just been talking about short pieces before, which makes it easy for me to read the whole piece and go through it with you guys. So this is the third in our series of webinars on article nuts and bolts, how to construct different article types. And this week we are talking about trend pieces. So today what we're going to be talking about is both the concept of a trend piece and how they fit in the landscape of travel writing and specifically magazines as a whole, and particularly how to construct them. So we're going to start by talking about what trends mean in the travel space. So then we're going to talk about the difference between trending and trend. When you hear trending, especially if you're online and you do social media, you probably think of in Twitter how it has trending, right? Or a lot of websites now will show you which topics are trending. So what is trending right now is not going to exactly be the trends that you see in travel magazines. So we're going to talk about that distinction. And then we're going to look at the overall layout of your average trend piece and how that plays out in different types of lengths. As I mentioned, for those of you that are just coming in, when I was pulling the pieces for us to look at today, I noticed that we've been mostly talking about front of book pieces lately that are short. And as we get into trends, those can be longer and longer pieces. In fact, you know, Carrie just mentioned a trend can be anything. And right now we're talking specifically in food and travel. As I was doing some research last night, I actually stumbled upon a magazine that I don't usually ever have occasion to read because most of my reading is work-related, Scientific American, which some of you may or may not be familiar with. And I was reading a piece which was actually, in fact, a trend piece, but it was a trend piece in terms of the intersection of certain scientific or certain conditions that are exhibiting in the population, but it was at heart a trend piece. You could see the structure that we're going to talk about today in this like 3,000 odd word feature in Scientific American. So these construction techniques that we're going to look at, you can accordion to all sorts of different lengths. So then at the end, we're going to talk about, I mentioned a few times that this webinar series that we're doing right now on article nuts and bolts is going to be interrupted by a couple interstitials on different topics. And we had a lot of people chiming in with interest about talking about freelance travel-related finances. So that's something we've got coming up, and also a few other things that I'm excited to share with you guys. So as we're talking about trend pieces this week, this is something that I think I got turned on to by force or by accident in a position that I had writing daily news for a website with a specific niche focus around Italian travel. Because when you are working in-house or on contract with a publication, you often learn a lot of these things just by force of exposure. So for all of you guys who haven't had that experience, you might not be so on with what all of the travel trends are, but this is really something fundamental for being a travel writer by profession. And we talked about this quite a bit in the end of the year, the annual review webinars as well, in terms of how that's something that is a fundamental part of your professional practice, of what you should be doing with your day. And I know a lot of magazine editors and publishers, the very first thing they do every morning is they sit down and they read what all of their competitors have published, every single other thing that's been published in their space, because they need to know what's already been written about. And do we freelancers have the time to do that? No, but they don't really either. So it's about kind of getting a practice for yourself of how you can skim and be on with all of these trends. So let's get into it. I already asked you guys this because there's a bit longer delay than usual in the sound. So I wanted to know what you guys thought was a trend in the concept, in the context of travel and food that you might see in the magazines. So I'm going to go through a couple here. So we've got, somebody mentioned poke, certainly a big food trend. Farm to table, people have mentioned Iceland, ramen. We've got craft cider, Nicaraguan retirement, van travel, food trucks. And some of these, you know, might be trends that as you see them in the chat box, you might not have heard of, like van travel, particularly like renovating an Airstream and living out of an Airstream and driving all over. That's actually like a really cool one, but quite niche. Likewise with Nicaraguan retirement. I like that's something that various among you might not have come across. But some of these like farm to table food or craft cider, I'm sure that all of you in Iceland, I'm sure all of you guys have heard about this. So I put together a list on my own just as I was thinking of what you guys might come up with. And I'm going to walk through them. And some of them you might be nodding your head right along with me, and other ones you might not have heard about. So, you know, we can think of things that were a trend and then how that trend grew up, right? So destination weddings at one point were a trend. How Nani said street food, that's another good one. But so destination weddings at one point were a trend. But now what's trending in that space of destination plus wedding or destination plus romance travel is baby moons, if you've heard of baby moons, or delayed honeymoons, where you get married and then maybe you can't take your honeymoon at that time for various reasons related to your job or economics or whatever, and you take it later. So then there's other things that have very strong economic motivators. I'm sure you guys have all heard of staycations. Another thing that was trendy a few years ago was road trips. Road trips had a big uptick. But another related thing to that is bleisure. And I'm going to write that in the chat box because I'm sure that you're not sure what I'm saying because it's such an effed up word that I wish someone had invented another one. So bleisure is when people who travel for work combine their work trips with their family travel. So essentially they use the fact that their business is flying them somewhere and then they bring their family along to join them for the week or the weekend after that to kind of like half save money because the flight is already paid for by the company for the primary person, but also just kind of out of their inability to find other vacation time as well. So bleisure is one that I think was coined about a year ago. And then there's some bigger ones that you guys probably know about, like agritourism has gotten big again. And that's like a larger, I guess, umbrella under which things like obviously farm to table, but also grass to glass, which is where a distillery, craft distilleries are huge, right? Where distilleries grow their own grain and hops on site to make their own things. So they only use local ingredients in the spirits that they make. There's other trends that happen in other parts of travel that touch all of us, right? Some people have mentioned things related to sort of driving or vehicles, but what about airplanes, right? Air travel. I think airline customer service screw-ups was like a trend a while ago, but that had a trend that came before it, which was cruise line screw-ups or, you know, people getting sick on cruises and things like that. So Ian's mentioned medical tourism. There's some of these things that aren't so much trends as much as sectors of travel, and it's important to know that difference because they're not as effective to use as a peg for your story if they're not a trend. So let's get into this further. I've given you guys some ideas, but we want to see them in real life, right? So trends that print magazines published are not going to be the absolute newest thing. And what I mean by that is if there is, I can't remember exactly what country this place is in, but there's a town, I believe in the Philippines, that has repainted the entire town in this very, very colorful fashion, just to lure tourists who like travel to take photos on Instagram. And in Asia, that's like a relatively common thing. You go somewhere for the photos. So it's not as quite as ridiculous as it sounds. So I've read about that online, but I don't know that that's going to make it into print because rejiggering the entire exterior of your town is something that's a little bit more of a one-off. And there's this concept that three is a trend that we'll talk about in a little bit. But that's part of what separates things that are the absolute newest new thing from the trends that you read about in a magazine or even in a newspaper, you know, which are theoretically daily. And I have this actually on the bottom of this slide, but I've read about things in the New York Times where that trend is like at least 3 years old. And if you look at the city guide type pieces that they do in the New York Times or other outlets, you might feel like, well, you know, that city isn't the really cool place to go right now, or that isn't the up-and-coming place to go right now. The up-and-coming place to go is actually something else. But they're not covering that place. And then you ask yourself why, like, why won't they take my pitch or why aren't they covering, you know, Columbia or something like that? And the answer in all of these cases is audience. With all of these publications, whether it's a newspaper or a magazine, they have very broad circulations typically, and they have to think about what is going to touch the most people. So for them, if they're going to cover a trend, the trend has probably become a bit mainstream when we're looking at travel and we're looking at a trend piece. Now, you can use a trend as a way to get in to write about a business profile, which we'll talk about later, both in this webinar, also next webinar on business profiles. But the thing is that in those cases, still the trend has to be well known enough. So does that mean it has to be so well known that your grandmother knows about it? Probably not. I like to think of it as a trend that your significant other or your best friend or somebody you know who has, you know, a quote unquote normal desk job, as in they are, you know, they work in sales or they're an architect or, you know, they work for the city. I'm just looking around New York right now trying to think of jobs. Or, you know, maybe they work in a recruiting firm, something like that. Somebody who has a job that has no touching of the travel industry, they probably should have, if not heard of it, at least have heard of the precursor of it. So that seems like, whoa, we're not actually really writing about things that are trending, are we? We're not actually really writing about what's new. And that's what I mean when I tell you, like, I read about this thing as a trend piece in the New York Times that was 3 years old. They have to wait for it to be big enough that they can justify to their audience that it is in fact trending. And I'm going to show you as we talk about the construction of these pieces, what does that mean? But another really good example is, this came up a lot during the Freelance Travel Writing Bootcamp, which I guess was just last week. Wow, it feels like it was like both a long time and a long time ago. Any of you guys who are there for the bootcamp that are on the chat today, I miss you guys. So in the bootcamp, we kind of had this running joke about the American Way magazine, because every time we looked for an example of something in American Way, it turned out that the writing wasn't really that great, or the trends that they talked about weren't really trends, because if they're way past being trends, everybody knows about them, it's just mainstream. And so they were kind of became the example of, like, don't write things like this. And sure enough, I was with a coaching student and we were doing this same kind of thing that you and I are talking about now, about looking at trends and diagramming articles and how they're put together and all those sorts of things. And one of the pieces that she looked at was about craft cider. Now, some of you guys might not have heard of cider, like hard cider as a thing, but it's pretty established. It's established to the point where somebody that I coach that came to one of our events just had a book come out on cooking with craft cider. So it's not even like a guide to craft cider, but it's how to cook with craft cider. So craft cider has been around long enough that a book publishing outfit would look for spin-offs of craft cider as a book, and she could have the time to test all the recipes and write the photos and get that book out. That's how long craft cider has been around. And the American Way magazine had as the very, very, very first piece in a recent front of book section, I think it was maybe the January issue, they had front and center this thing, craft cider has arrived, or like, you should check out craft cider. So really, these trends that we're talking about to us as travelers and travel writers might feel over, actually, because we're so immersed in this. So one of these ones, right, is like street food. I feel like street food has so many iterations, right? We could think of street food as food carts. We can think of street food as street food, you know, like in Southeast Asia or night markets. It has so many iterations. But you have to ask yourself, is this something that in Columbus, Ohio, everybody already knows about this? Or is this something that, you know, in San Francisco or Boston or LA, people might know about it there? And that's kind of the dividing line. Does everybody everywhere already know about it? Or do most people kind of who are plugged into food and travel, who are not in the industry, but live kind of in urban hip areas, do they all know about it? That's a good dividing line. So for instance, what's cool right now in Portland is not going to show up in a travel magazine for another 2 or 3 years, most likely, right? So if you don't feel like you know these things that are trending right now that you can be pitching on a 6 month timeline, because by then they will actually be trendy, how do you find out? First, you can look at what magazines are already covering. That'll help you gauge what the level is so that you can really understand it of what is trendy enough to appear. And it's really easy to skim through once a month. They only come out once a month. The front of book sections of these four magazines and know what's going on. Something that I also like to do is to get the daily or weekly or whenever they come out emails from these four places that I listed here. Now it's a slightly eclectic group, so I want to explain it to you. So I put Condé Nast Traveler, which I also put up there on the major publications, but I put Condé Nast Traveler here because they have a really great daily newsletter or daily sort of email that they send out. And it's always got newsy pieces. Condé Nast Traveler does a lot of newsy pieces about what's going on in travel that affects leisure travelers. And so I read that quite religiously. It's probably like one of the few email newsletters that I get that I probably open every time. And it's not just because I open it intending to open it, but it's because they always have a headline. They always have some newsy thing that I feel like I, as a travel writer and a teacher of travel writing, need to know about to know what's going on in travel. So I definitely recommend getting it. CNT Daily or CN Traveler Daily is their daily newsletter. And then this one might seem a little out there. So there's this website called Well Plus Good, which probably not too many of you are familiar with. And I actually got turned on to it because other writers were saying it was really great and they wanted to write for it. And so then I started getting their newsletter. And they have a very, very extensive travel section. They don't cover it as widely in their newsletter because it's a little bit more about wellness, but they have a huge travel section. And they really cover a lot of what's kind of on the cutting edge in terms of what consumers are doing that isn't going to appear in a magazine right now, but it's something that you can pitch in a year or a year and a half so that you can start looking out for resources and experts and studies and statistics on that. We'll talk more about those things in a minute. So for instance, a recent Well Plus Good highlighted, they had a piece that highlighted a website that specifically finds, I want to say it was like co-working spaces or remote working situations for female entrepreneurs or executives of small companies. It was super, super small, but that's like the next stage of digital nomadism, is people who can work anywhere and currently aren't having these concierge services that sort out their apartment for them so that they're guaranteed that the Wi-Fi will be great and they'll have a great place to work and a kitchen and that it'll be near cool cafes, who set them up with meetup groups to go to and all of those things. That's the next stage of co-working and digital nomadism right there. And I've heard a couple other things like this since seeing that article, but it's so new yet. It's not quite ready to go to a magazine, but it's something I can file in my idea file and start thinking about where that can go. So two other things on here that are more industry focused are Skift, which I mentioned pretty often, particularly for knowing what's going on with the industry. They do a lot of white papers that are very, very expensive, but you can always get a preview, like a small section of the white paper, and they're really great, and they have lots of anecdotes. And Travel Weekly, I know some of you guys have backgrounds in travel or travel planning or being a travel agent or things like that on the industry side, so you might already be familiar with this publication. But for those of you that don't, people who work in travel who are like travel agents, they really need to know in a very up to the minute, like day by day way, what's going on in different places. Like after the Paris attack, what was the tone on the ground? Like, should they tell their people to go there or not? And that is who Travel Weekly is targeting. So if you look there, you're getting the information for the people who are curating the information for travelers. So that is also really a great source of what's trending and what's the status in different places. So three's a trend. You may have heard me mention this earlier. How many of you guys have heard this term? Three. Okay, I see somebody who was with us last week, two people who were with us last week for the boot camp have heard me mention it. Alicia's heard it. Okay, it's kind of split down the middle. So this idea of three is a trend is a journalist trick that you go around and you hear something, right? Like this service that I just mentioned that sets up digital nomad experiences for specifically female entrepreneurs, female CEOs of small companies. And then you're like, wow, I could use that, or that sounds great, or I should tell my friend, that's super cool and specific. And then, you know, it just kind of files away in your memory in the cool stuff category, or perhaps in your inbox. I used to have, when I first started writing, I had a cool stuff category or in my email, and I had different folders for each place that I covered frequently. So I had a cool stuff Italy, cool stuff Boston, all of these different ones. So then how does it become three's a trend? This is usually what happens. After you hear the the first one, at some point you'll hear something like that from somebody else. So a few days ago, somebody mentioned to me another digital nomad thing like this, where they set everything up for you. But again, it has a restriction that they only do it in one city each month. So there's like other people who are doing the program at the same time that are there with you. And so that one's a bit different, but it's still got this concept of everybody setting it up. So then once I hear two like this that are similar, I would say, okay, is this a thing? Are there other companies doing this? And then I would hit Google, and then I would Google around quite a bit and look for other places that are doing something similar, and particularly try to see if I can get ones that are more similar than these two examples that I gave you. Because the thing is that these examples that are kind of outliers, you can use those to talk about other variations on the trend, but it's great if you can find ones that are quite similar for this three as a trend metric. So like I said in here, this can be a type of facile trend reporting. So if you hear one instance and you hear another one and you find a third, can you automatically write a trend article? No. Three as a trend is just an indicator that you need to look into it. Three as a trend is not the way that you write your piece. That would just be a roundup, okay? And trend pieces aren't roundups. Trend pieces are talking about the trend itself as a piece of news. And so if you look up how to write a trend piece, there's some very, very funny things that come up, and we're going to look at some of those in a minute. But there's interestingly a lot of backlash from mostly writers, it seems, about these as being not necessarily easy or something like that, but about being the types of things that outlets like the New York Times should not spend their time publishing. But the fact of the matter is that trend pieces are important. They're cultural commentaries, and they're things that those people who don't already know about these trends want to read because they want to know what this thing is and why they should know about it. And the people who already know about those trends, they get to see how expansive it is. They get to learn something about that trend that they don't already know, and they get to see how the trend originated and where it's going next. So they're really great pieces when done well, but the when done well is the important part. So to make sure, and this is kind of, again, one of those lines that you see between something that somebody might write unedited on their own blog versus the kind of trend piece that you're going to see in a magazine. So like, just like any of you who have blogged, I know that back in my prior life, before I also became a journalist, besides just being a blogger, I'm certainly guilty of this, okay, is pulling together things that are similar and calling it a trend, but not doing any of this backup on how the trend came to be, what shows that it's really there, and how it fits into society in a larger context, okay? So one of the best ways to do that, to show that in your piece, is to give different types of information for people who need different types of proof. So some people, storytelling is it. Like, they hear a story and they'll believe anything you tell them. But that's not everybody, right? Some people make decisions only on facts, only on figures. And some people need experts. They need to hear it from somebody who either specializes in this or has some sort of degree in this area. So if you've ever studied logic, they call these fallacies of authority. When you use somebody who is an expert, but not an expert in exactly that thing. So they don't quite prove, they don't quite have the weight to prove what you're talking about. And that's one of these cases where a trend piece can also often fall flat. So one of the pieces that I'm going to show you later is on this topic called transformative travel. And we'll talk more about what that is when we get to the trend piece that we're going to look at. But the basic concept, the basic tenet of transformative travel is that it's travel that when you go there, you're seeing something that's so different from your normal life or the experience that you have, you know, saving baby rhinos, something like that. I'm not making that up. Like, completely changes how you feel about all sorts of things in your life when you come home. Now, a lot of us probably practice transformative travel already, write about it, you know, maybe have heard the term or maybe not. But for travel writers, it tends to be quite a kind of normal thing. But now some people have stuck a name on it, and now apparently it is a trend. So transformative travel is something where who could you take as the expert to talk about that? You could take somebody who owns a company that specializes in transformative travel, but they might, that might be a fallacy of authority if nobody cares about that company, if that company doesn't have success, if that company isn't very well known. You could take somebody from a major tour operator, but if that tour operator doesn't really care, you know, so much about experiences, if it's somebody who just kind of does like booze cruises, that also is not going to ring true in this context. So the best thing that you could do is to choose, you know, a tour company that has a certain amount of weight in the marketplace, but they're also known for experiential kind of responsible travel, like G Adventures or something like that. I'm not quite sure what you mean by your question, Carrie, but this would be, you couldn't just throw in a random tourism board to comment on transformative travel because there's no backup of why that person specifically is qualified to talk about this thing. So if that's what you meant, that is the answer. So as you line up expert sources to talk about your trend, it's really important to remember not just that they touch on your trend, but also that they have enough kind of verifiable, clear backing that it's clear that they are qualified to talk about this trend. If in doubt, you know, you can always watch like some primetime, you know, lawyer show and see how people shred witnesses that are not really good expert witnesses, and you'll see this fallacy of authority that I'm talking about. So I'm going to show you a specific format that incorporates these real life examples, hard data, and expert sources. So this piece, I'm going to leave it up here and take a water break for a second. I seem to need a lot of water today. This piece, I'm going to leave it up here so you guys can look at it, and then I'm going to read it to you guys sort of in a skimming way. I've already cut some things out of it that aren't so apropos for the format that we are looking at today. But this piece that I've put up here, it's on two slides. It is from The New Yorker, and it is from their humor column. And the concept here is that they are kind of paraphrasing essentially what is in every single trend piece. So I'll give you guys a second to look at that while I answer Carrie's question. Haru, we've talked about a couple times, but it's Help a Reporter Out. And it's a website you can use to find sources for your pieces. Okay, guys, so take a look at that for one sec. So as you can see, this is clearly a humorous piece, as denoted by the very first line. Some sexy stuff, says pseudonym, not his or her real name, because he or she is the writer's friend on Facebook, a vague professional from a major city. Now, what's quite funny about this is that I have heard, I'm not going to say a lot, I have definitely heard people who are editors at magazines or write regularly for magazines say things like, no, Alan, that's a good question. I'll explain in a sec. I've definitely heard people who write a lot of stories say that sometimes when they're trying to get a piece done and they're feeling stuck, they just go on Facebook and say, hey, can somebody give me a quote about blah, blah, blah? And this is not uncommon. And I've particularly heard people who write for some of the major travel industry publications say this, and they were actually telling that to a room of travel agents to tell them why they should be on Facebook is just to get press. So, but this whole piece, actually, as much as it is, you know, clearly poking fun, like I said, I've taken out some of the things that are a little too far in the poking fun category, but it's very specifically following the format of what goes in a trend piece. So they start with a very interesting quote, and then they explain who is being quoted, and then they have some other information to follow up and make the quote make sense. This is something that I see people who aren't so used to including quotes miss, and I've actually had some editors of mine have to send out some kind of humorous updates to their guidelines. You should always have the first sentence of your quote and then break it up by explaining the person's name and who they are. So if interviewing isn't something you've done a lot of before, this is the format you need to do this. So after that quote sets the scene, and I'll talk a little bit more about how that's often an anecdote, then they explain what they're talking about. They are talking about this trend, and you won't just see it here. You'll see it in several other places. And then they say, here's the trend. This is what the trend is. And then they get into the hard evidence. They get into some statistics or something from, it's typically not an academic journal in our area, though it can be. I've seen some, and you will with the transformative travel piece. It's more often either an industry study or the, not just the US government, but a lot of governments have their statistics up where you can very easily find them. So you can use transportation department statistics, all sorts of different things for that backing. Now, Alan had a funny question here, which some people might not be so familiar with, especially if you mostly write online, but this concept of the fold, it's that above the fold are the things that you see in a website before you scroll down. So it also has a application and websites. So it's like everything that comes before the first scroll. And these days there tends to also be an ad there. So it's like everything above the first ad. Well, in newspapers, it's the fold is literal, right? It's like where that newspaper is folded at the bottom. However, these days it tends to be that the fold has different pieces underneath it and you actually need to switch to another page. And they try to make sure that everything that happens there on that first page before the fold makes you really interested so that you either scroll or you flip to whatever it is, like D17 that you need to be looking at. Jade had a question. Should we be lining up these expert interviews before we pitch? This is a great question. Ask me that again at the end because we're going to talk about how to pitch these pieces. So let's look at the next half of this humor piece about trend pieces. So then we've got another quote from another person, and they call them a trend spotter, a freelance expert. So this is that place where we want to be including that expert who can speak to this trend, okay? So we've had our bit of, you know, industry research or statistic or something like that. So now we need somebody that we can quote that's both capable of and their background shows that they ought to be commenting on this. And then the piece goes into examples. When we talked, those of you who joined us for the piece about, or the webinar about news briefs, we talked about this inverted pyramid and that further down in the piece, they tend to give like lots more examples or they talk about like kind of offshoots of this thing. This is the part of the trend piece where that happens. This is where rather than just mentioning, you know, you may have seen it in New York or Rio or London, they give other examples. They talk about other companies that are doing this. This is where I would do kind of like a mini profile or explanation of each of the companies that I've identified that's doing this, setting up executives or entrepreneurs as digital nomads in different countries, if that's what I was doing for this piece. And then all of these trend pieces take another step. They show how that trend fits into other things that are going on in the world. So before when we talked about road trips and staycations, that was during a time when the economy was down and people wanted to still vacation, especially with their families, but they just didn't have money to go very far. And so they were looking at doing interesting things in their own backyard or rediscovering their own cities or going to small towns nearby them that they would never think of visiting. So in this place, I would explain, you know, that that's what's happening and talk perhaps about other things that might come next or other ways that that frugality, or not just frugality, but desire to experience things fully with limited means was expressing itself, maybe in the food scene or maybe in the hospitality industry. And I would touch on, you know, Airbnbs or things like that, like where you could take a room in an apartment rather than just rent an apartment. And then the last quote, these pieces typically have three interviews or three quotes, will say something that follows in line with the previous paragraph, that they're going to pull that larger scale, that larger look at how this trend fits into society succinctly into a quote that perfectly encapsulates a 2-hour interview into one sentence, as the New Yorker humorously says. So I went through this, but just to have it on paper, what did we see in here? There's a lead with a quote, preferably an anecdote. So this piece that I read in Scientific American last night that I was telling you guys about, it was a very long piece. So it began with a very long anecdote about a particular child and talking about him. I think it was probably about five paragraphs was the anecdote that began that piece. And then they talked again, just as in this humorous look at a trend piece that we just read in the New Yorker, they expanded on how it's not just this child, it's not just this business, you know, it's not just this airline committing these obnoxious customer service foibles. It's happening in a lot of places. And then they move into the data. And then another quote about, or context, if you can't get a quote, but the origin of the trend. And then that this list like thing where you expand on the different examples, but relatively quickly. And then touching on the broader significance of the trend. So this is a kind of 6-point formula for what we typically see in a trend piece. But what I wanted to point out, because I don't want you guys to go out into the wild after this and see things and say that's a trend piece, but it doesn't look like what Gabby told me, is that similar to what I said in the newsletter and the blog post preceding today's call, trends show up as a time peg, as a sort of mechanism for explaining why this piece is important in really a lot of pieces and a lot of different types of pieces, especially in the front of book of different magazines. So this is a little tiny, but you don't need to read it, and we can flip over to the full version of the other ones if you want, but I've also pulled the text out, so they should be bigger. But I'm just showing you a couple quick pieces where a trend is the starting point. So this is from like a January or February magazine, and it says it's a small plates world. I think we can all agree that tapa style things or small plates are a trend that is so ubiquitous that it's pretty much been done, right? So small plates have been around for a while. That's like a trend that's established like farm to table food, right? So, but they're using this as an entree for a place that's mingling Japanese and Spanish cuisine with a Michelin star chef from San Sebastian, which has the highest Michelin stars per capita, and somebody with a pop-up ramen shop. So they're taking in ramen and a place that's super known for its food and adding that to the small plates trend and creating this piece, which is effectively like a business profile or a chef profile. But they're using that trend as a jumping off point to get you to look, because if they just said, here's a random chef that you've never heard of, she's not a celebrity chef in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where you're probably not going to go, or maybe aren't going to go for another year or two, doing things with Japanese and Spanish food, you might not really care. Okay. So here's another one. So this one I actually pulled because it's a fake trend piece. So you can't see it on here. I think it got cut off when I cut the top. But this is a city guide. This is on San Juan Island, Washington. And I believe this is from Delta Sky magazine. And the section that it's in is called Trending. But I want to read for you, because I know it's super tiny and hard to read. I want to read for you what it actually says in here, because this just cracked me up, because there's absolutely nothing trending or trendy that they have pegged this piece to. So they said this outdoor enthusiast's dream is quickly gaining cred as a serious culinary destination. So they say, reachable by passenger ferry or seaplane from Seattle, the most populous of the San Juan Islands has long been a top spot for experiencing marine wildlife. Thanks to an abundance of local bounty, I don't even know what that is, salal berries and bull kelp, artisan chefs now are putting this remote destination on the culinary map. Seattleites trek to the gourmet archipelago for its restaurants, vineyard, brewery, distillery, shellfish farm, and agriculture. So the thing is, like, they've explained kind of the why now, but like San Juan Island is not a place that is actually trending on a scale for us to just write a trend piece about San Juan Island as a culinary destination, okay? But they're just using that as a peg, and they're using the fact that more people are traveling for food. You know, if this piece was longer, they could have put a quote in about that. There's a lot of statistics about that. And they've got, you know, the favorite words, breweries, distilleries, agriculture. So they've got a lot of trends that they've pulled in to make it sound like this place is a place you need to go now. But it couldn't be written up just as San Juan is now on the map, like San Sebastian in Spain, as a culinary hotspot that's drawing in global foodies. They couldn't write that piece. So they've pulled on a bunch of different sort of name drop trends to get you into this piece. Okay, so I've got one more also city guide trend kind of thing, and I know it's hard to read, but this is something that, like that piece we just saw, actually a city guide, this one is not called trending, but what this does is it takes a place that is very trendy. So like a name or a neighborhood that you will see come up a lot. So it's probably going to be, this is from Hemispheres, it's probably going to be a city that's big, and it'll just be the neighborhood where a lot of new things are opening. And they're tying that into a lot of other bigger trends. So there's all sorts of different ways that trends are expressed that aren't exactly trend pieces. So again, this is a 6-point formula specifically for trend pieces, just to remind you. And now I'm going to pull up, I've got 5 lined up for you of different lengths, 2 that are short that we can actually read through together. And then, or maybe I only have 4. I think I have 5. 2 that are short that we can read through together, and then a couple others that I can show you how this works in a larger format, right? So we typically lead with a quote, probably an anecdote if we can. We expand on how this occurs. We move into the data. We talk about the trend's origin. We give examples of it in the wild, and then we talk about the broader significance. So I can see that this is too small for you guys to read. So I'm going to pull up the actual text, and we're going to switch over to that for a second. So this one, I believe, is bone broth. Yep. Okay. So this one is about, how many of you guys have heard of bone broth? Let me know in the chat box while I'm bringing this up. I've kind of only had it in Portland, and then I saw it in Boston the other day, and I've heard about it, but I've just never really seen it too much in the wild. So I don't know if this is too much better to read now, but I'm going to read this to you. So this piece takes bone broth, which is a trend that kind of came from paleo. It's like an offshoot of paleo, if we're talking trend-wise. And someone who I know is vegetarian says, oh, and I agree. But this is not talking about bone broth as a trend. This is talking about how bone broth is now being incorporated by bartenders into cocktails. So you can often take a trend, something that you know about, like farm table food or craft breweries. Oh my God, I can't believe it's a Costco. But you can take something that you know is a trend and show how it's infiltrating another area, and ta-da, brand new trend piece. So that's what this is here, and I'm going to show you that as well with the next one. So they've taken bone broth, and they've said, taking stock, bartenders trace trendy bone broth's boozy backstory. Step aside, green juice. Bone broth has been embraced as a hip new magic bullet cure-all, a paleo-approved sipper that draws on the nose-to-tail philosophy of no-waste cooking. As evidence of the trend, dedicated bone broth shops have opened on both coasts, from New York's Brodo to the Broth Bar in Portland, Oregon. Bartenders, too, are getting in on the trend. At Midnight Rambler in Dallas, mixologist Chad Solomon serves up a globe-trotting spin on the classic bullshot, the 50-era's riff on the Bloody Mary, which trades tomato juice for canned broth. I absolutely agree that it's gross, Alicia. His faux king champ combines overproof wheat vodka, oloroso sherry, lime juice, and Vietnamese pho beef broth. New quote. The idea was to take a look at the classic bullshot and create a new forward-thinking drink through the lens of Vietnamese pho, says Solomon. We started with beef broth, then roast onions and ginger, and used star anise, cassia bark, green cardamom, and black pepper to aromatize the broth, which is then enhanced with sriracha, hoisin sauce, MSG, and Maggi seasoning to boost the umami quality. At La Pistola, Aaron Melendrez spikes lamb consomme with Glenlivet 15 for the off-the-menu From the Kitchen with Love. I came to chef with the concept, he said, and he thought I was sort of crazy, says Melendrez. It took a few days of explaining to get him on board. Clearly the chef here agreed with you guys. He then prepared me his best consomme, we paired it, and we knew we had a winner. At Top Chef finalist Brian Voltaggio's DC restaurant range, broth appears on the cocktail menu in the form of meat ice, a frozen pop made with a Bloody Mary-inspired consommé that includes roasted bones, meat scraps, San Marzano tomato sauce, herbs, vegetables, bacon, and other smoked meats. Beverage director Dane Nakamura then slides the pop into scotch for his vegan sacrifice. Drinkers can stir their drink with the meat pop and slowly enjoy the cocktail as the ratio of broth to booze switches, or take a bite of the popsicle and chase the drink, says Nakamura. Learning what they do in the kitchen on a daily basis is an incredible way to expand the spectrum of knowledge that can be applied behind the bar. Okay, so personal philosophies on bone broth aside, there's also a recipe after this, which I didn't include, which probably would have all sorts of bones and things in it. So let's look at how the format fits into this, right? So in this case, because the piece is so short and everything always changes when things are short, they didn't open with the anecdote. They didn't open with a quote. They cut off that top anecdote or quote and saved that for after. So they started by telling us that bone broth is a trend, and now it's showing up in cocktails. So they essentially switched to that second paragraph. And then they get into the anecdote afterwards, okay? And this is the one about Chad Solomon. And then they have his quote. And they use this quote from him both to explain what's happening and also to explain the philosophy behind this, which is to create a cocktail that tastes like a dish. And then they go through the other examples. And it's super, like, obvious format here, right? Like, one paragraph per person. You know, it's got the quote from the other guy, and then it ends with that quote of how it expands, right? So they're talking about how you can include the popsicle, how you can have it with or stir it in. But then he has this quote that talks about something greater, which is learning what they do in the kitchen on a daily basis is an incredible way to expand the spectrum of knowledge that can be applied behind the bar. So that's kind of looking forward. Like, what else from the kitchen are you going to soon see appearing on your cocktail menu? So let's look at this other short one that I've got for you guys. This one takes bees. Who's seen bees or like roof-made honey as a trend? That's a big one. And especially pairing agritourism offerings like beer and things like that with honey. During the boot camp, we went to a brewery where they had partnered with a local honey producer to keep, I'm totally blanking on the name, but the beehives on site and then create honey that was specifically under their label. So this one is about how Asheville is becoming the Napa Valley of honey. That's their deck, okay? So it's taking this bee thing that you kind of know is trendy and also Asheville that was trendy and putting them together. Asheville boasts more craft breweries per capita than any U.S. city. Now North Carolina's hipster hub is pollinating an even sweeter industry, from the French Broad Food Co-op, which keeps hives on its rooftop, to the 200 colonies nurtured by fourth-generation Biltmore Estate beekeeper Ed Buchanan. The town has gone honey crazy. We are Bee City USA, says DJ Ivar Schlotz, the owner and head mazer or mead maker at Bee and Bramble, which produces dry honey wine. It's not just a nickname. With colony collapse disorder decimating the world's honeybee populations, Asheville has become the first American city to officially ban harmful pesticides. I am gratified by the increased interest in protecting these lovely creatures, says Schlotz. Without their pollination effects, many of the people alive today would starve. That might be a bit of a stretch, but it's a great quote, and that's, I'm sure, why it's in here and why the quote is what says it and not the journalist, because how could you back that up? It seems you find honey everywhere here, continues the article. It's mixed into the mountain honey body wrap at the Omni Grove Park Inn Spa, drizzled on biscuits at Tupelo Honey Cafe, and stirred into cocktails at the bar Sovereign Remedies, a great place to go to if you ever go to Asheville. Katie Button of Night Bell uses local honey in her Hush Puppies with honey butter, while French Broad Chocolates infuses lavender truffles with Hay Creek Wildflower honey. The Asheville Bee Charmer sells more than 50 types from around the world, such as wild carrot flower honey from Italy, Manuka flower honey from Tasmania, and Jameson-infused honey from Scotland. Quote, people are usually surprised at how different honeys can taste, end quote, says co-owner Kim Allen. Quote, a blackberry honey from the Northwest, for example, tastes completely different from a local blackberry honey. That's terroir, as the French would say. Unquote. Beer, too, is getting in on the act. Wicked Weed Brewing makes a malicious honey lavender ale and Mompara honey ale, while Burial Beer uses Haw Creek honey in its Keeper's Vale Honey Saison and Reaper Triple. Last fall saw the opening of Bramari, a brewery whose signature offering is a black pale ale made with local sourwood honey. The brewery's namesake, the Hindu goddess of bees. So here you'll see an example of what I was talking about today earlier, where they were talking about honey before in terms of, you know, how they are producing it and how it's being used in food. And then the way they take it sort of to the larger level is that they talk about, you know, how it's also incorporated into spa products, or how it's not just their own honey, but in Asheville, you can also learn about honeys from all over the world and how honey is different from one place to the next. And then, of course, they started with beer, and so they tie it back into the beer. Okay, so this is, again, example like that last one, where the format is a bit flipped because it's such a short piece that they don't have that space in the beginning to open with that quote and go into the anecdote. So first they set the scene. First they tell you that nut graph style, what they're going to talk to you about. And then they have the guy who tells you why it's important. And they touch on colony collapse disorder, which is also, I don't know that you would say it's trendy, but I would say that it's a scientific thing that has an amazingly widespread recognition, kind of like climate change. But some people still say that it doesn't exist, I'm sure, in terms of colony collapse disorder. So in this case, you'll see that they have a lot of examples, whereas the last piece that we looked at had those three examples in three paragraphs. So that last piece might have been a case where the bone broth in a bartender setting is so new that it was hard to get their hands on a lot of examples, whereas here they obviously have tons. So you'll see both of these types of pieces, ones where they have very list style additional, you know, iterations, or ones where they have more of a single business quote explaining what they do approach, like we saw in that last piece. So let me get the slides back up for you here. So I told you we have a couple longer ones, and I cut and pasted them in, so it should be pretty easy to read, but otherwise I can flip over to them on my browser. So this one here is from Condé Nast Traveler. Now, I had heard of suitcases with things in them, but I haven't heard of robotic suitcases that you don't need to push yourself. So this piece specifically speaks to the fact that it's a trend piece by saying robotic suitcase is the trend the world doesn't need. Now, I wanted to show you guys this because sometimes trend pieces have a bit of judgment in them. They are framing the trend as something that, like it says here, we might not actually need. So here they open again, because this is a very short piece, with a slightly overview style intro, which is sort of cutting right to that nut graph style thing of telling the reader what they're going to be learning about. So it's talking about self-driving suitcases and that they were seen all around the Consumer Electronics Show, and how each model is slightly different, but the idea is that it pulls itself. And so then they give the anecdote here, and they talk about one called the 90 Fun Puppy, which is Segway style, self-balancing two-wheel roller. And then they've actually pulled a quote from the New York Times, which is quite interesting. And this is not something that you would see if you were writing this for the magazine, but this is, like I said, a piece that's from Condé Nast Traveler's website. So then they go on to say what people thought about this piece. They're talking about, again, they're trying to incorporate experts, but because they didn't quite do the research here, you can see that it's a little tough. So they have another quote from another article that appeared somewhere else, talking about some reviewers having mixed things to say about the rolling suitcases. And then they do that listing other examples. So then they talk about three different companies that are also making self-rolling luggage, and then the expansion. So buyers should beware of the next wave, because ever-changing security requirements have made it so that you often have to take the batteries out of these bags when you get to the airport. And I saw another piece recently in Condé Nast Traveler about people getting totally screwed because they couldn't take their bags on the plane. So this is a super short piece here. I mean, for online, for print, this would be kind of long, and that's why it's not quite as packed in. I would say this piece is probably around 250 words. And you'll see that the point about the trend is not as well made as in some of these other pieces that we looked at. And part of that is because this is an online piece. So I've got one other piece from, I believe this is also from them, about why transformative travel will be the travel trend of 2017. Now, this is a much longer and in-depth piece, and you'll immediately see the difference in the type of reporting. So they open by saying experiential travel was the trend of 2016. What's next? And then they move right away with this one into, like we've seen in those other pieces, they didn't open with the anecdote. They move right away into telling you what they're going to tell you about. And then they stepped into that expected, according to that format that we're looking at, that expected thing of taking it to the expert level and having that expert tell you about what the trend is and what does that mean. So they explain that there's now a transformational travel collaborative, and they have Jake Halpert, who's the founder and president of a company called Evergreen Escapes, as well as the Transformational Travel Collaborative, explain, today's culture is device and pace driven. We're disconnecting from ourselves, our relationships, nature, and culture. The external pieces of an itinerary don't reveal the inner journey a trip can inspire. So he's setting up the scene for why this trend exists. Now, I know this one is a bit shorter, or sorry, that this text here is a bit smaller, and I'm not going to read this one in a lot of detail because I've already given you a few examples. But this goes into actual scientific research. I mentioned I had one example for you that does this. So it's talking about somebody who did a doctoral study on the elements of adventure travel that lead to deeper transformations. And it goes through and it talks about the results of that study. And then they have another quote, we're at a point where the planet needs a higher consciousness and transformational travel can give us that. It's the step beyond authenticity and experiential travel that we need. So this is that quote when we looked at the New Yorker piece where they said, you know, Trendspotter, a freelance expert, says this thing that sounds really cool. That's what this quote is. And then it goes on to that listing of other companies where you can see that. Many travel companies already see this shift occurring. They talk about GeoX, which is a big company. They talk about Nature Habitat Adventures. They're talking to a lot of different companies that do outdoor travel and how they are incorporating transformative travel into their offerings. We've got another company that they're talking to here. And then they get into that what's next. And so let me pull over to the actual piece so I can read you this. They've got a really great line here where they explain that bigger picture, the kind of takeaway from this piece and why this trend matters to all of us and why the magazine decided to spend all this time writing it. In our often superficial hyper-connected world, a landscape where the merits of a vacation are measured by Instagram likes rather than actual impact, it's no wonder that the traveler of 2017 will be looking for a deeper shift that lasts long after the physical journey ends. Now, I promised Lindsay that I would get back to her piece or her question, and here we are. I want to talk really quickly because we've gone a bit over on how we pitch these pieces. So her question was, do we need to line up? Sorry, it was Jade's question, right? Let me find it. Yeah. Should we line up these expert interviews before we pitch? Now, you never need to line up an interview before a piece of any kind unless your piece will completely fall apart without that interview. So in some cases, it's because it's a profiler. The whole piece is an interview of one person, and you simply couldn't sell it unless you can get that person's agreement to give you a quote. But if there are different people who could give an opinion on that, you don't want to necessarily say, and I will interview this, this, and that person. You want to say, I will interview people like. And the reason for that is that you might interview one of those people and find that they're horrible and they don't give good quotes and that you need to get somebody else to use in the piece. And so you don't want to hem yourself down in terms of who you're going to interview, but you do need to look up and make sure there are sources available that could comment on this. And when I say sources available, I don't mean like that they're time-wise available. I mean that they're out there. That's part of that research that I talked about way back at the top of the call, where I said you see the second iteration of something and then you hit Google and see if it's a thing. And so in the case of that transformational travel piece, you could see that there they were just talking to other people who owned adventure travel companies or experiential travel companies. And that's what you would do in a case like that. So if I, you know, was writing that theoretical piece I had outlined about these places that do nomadic placements for entrepreneurs, who would I interview? I would see if there's other companies that I could talk to about that, sure. But I might also talk to somebody in a really major co-working space that's already around the world, like WeWork or something like that. I could also talk to the people who run Remote Year, which is a company that does something sort of similar, but sideways. So I could talk to people who are doing related things as well. So you don't want to have your pitch go out without knowing that you have a really solid anecdote, knowing that you have a really solid story from at least one person that illustrates the trend. And so that might be on the about page of one of the companies that you're looking at, or it could be the first time that somebody told you about this, the first time that you heard about it. So you know a person that has actually experienced this firsthand. But you want to make sure that you have a story with a compelling narrative that you can include in your piece, unless it's one of those super, super tiny short ones, in which case you don't need that, because as you saw, they don't open with those, right? They just get those in the quotes later on. So if you're looking to pitch these and you're not super sure that you're really clear on it, I recommend starting with these not at that longer length, like that transformational travel piece that we looked at, but in those shorter iterations. They're very formulaic. They're very easy to write up. So don't pitch one of these unless you're really solid on it to an editor that doesn't know you, especially if you haven't done them before. But they're very easy to write for travel trade magazines and niche magazines. So if you have an editor that you're already working with, that's great to try this out on them, to pitch them a trend piece, especially a longer one as a feature. Okay, we had a question over here from Beth. The Future 100. There's a lot of, if you start looking up travel trends just in Google, you'll see a lot of people putting out these, you know, 100 travel trends we expect to see and blah, blah, blah. At the end of the year and the beginning of the year is when there tends to be a lot of those. And I always peruse those every year. So thank you guys so much for talking about trend pieces. Next week, we're talking about business profiles, which I'm really excited about. They're really like a bread and butter piece for travel writers. And the answer to questions that a lot of people have of, I'm on this press trip, but I have no idea what to write about. So we're going to talk all about that next week. And the sun has finally come out here. I hope it's nice where you guys are, and have a really great weekend.